Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 269 of Registry Matters. Good evening, sir. Happy Saturday night. I almost said Friday. Happy Saturday night. How are you?
Doing awesome. And I'm glad you invited me back again.
Yeah, I probably have something to say something about that.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
I guess that would be the case if I can't find anybody else to sit in for your in place of you.
Oh, I love that voice.
Well, make sure that you head over to YouTube, press like and subscribe, and write a review in your favorite podcast app. Do all of those things, and that will make us so happy, and people will find the content and make our audience grow and all of that. That would be fantastic. Did you engage with anybody on YouTube this week?
I don't think so, but I did see a comment on YouTube. Did you want to read that comment?
Oh God! I can vamp for a minute, and I'll go find it if you want.
Oh, I'll go find. I can basically say what it said. He asked, the person asked, if we never do any challenges, how we're going to find out what's doable, something to that effect. He said, "Well, you two sound like you don't believe in challenges, and we actually do believe in challenges, but we believe in doing challenges that are put together correctly and focused properly." And using the right vehicle, like sometimes declaratory judgment is the correct vehicle, sometimes it isn't. It's all about the doing litigation correctly, filing, throwing everything up at the kitchen sink like they did in Michigan and hoping something sticks was not a very wise strategy. But we absolutely have to keep trying things if we're going to keep chipping away at this. But that was in essence what the question or comment was.
You didn't write that question, did you?
No.
I just went and looked at him. I was like, Larry, that's you.
Oh, well, that came to me and I put it on YouTube, actually.
And you did get two thumbs up on it, though.
Is that right?
You did. Now, I don't know who did that. I didn't do it. So you have some loyal fans out there that are saying, yep, that's what we need to do. Do you want to give us a rundown for the show tonight?
It's going to be a hodgepodge of stuff. We have two comments from Chris. We have another comment and question from a person who wants to move to Germany. We have an audio clip that came in, I guess, by phone, submitted. And then we have a question about someone who wants to move from California to New Mexico, Interstate Compact. Then we've got this main event. We're talking about a circuit court decision that I think you're going to be fascinated by it. You told me you read it, right? You read that 105 pages.
Shoot, man, I have it memorized.
All right, well, then we're going to do that. And so let's roll the train.
All right, well, before we get started, don't you have some sort of funny story regarding your trip to the motor vehicle division yesterday?
I do.
I bet it's not funny, but you think it's funny. So we'll be the judge of if it's funny.
Oh, it's definitely funny. All right, so I've made an appointment. They only accept appointments, no walk-ins anymore. And New Mexico has a hybrid system where they run private and public, meaning that you can use a private operator and you pay the registration or the license fee, all those fees, but then you pay the private company for the additional services. So if a license is $34, you might pay another $24 for the convenience fee of using the private company. The private company, you know, the private companies do everything better. They have better staff and they have better customer service and all this kind of stuff. Anything the government does, they screw it up, right?
Right.
Okay. So I go make my appointment online and I'm running late because there's an accident on the west side of the city. You have to cross the river to get into town and I was on the west side. So I'm running a little bit behind schedule and then I run into construction. And I see my appointment time of 11 o'clock, and I'm thinking, well, gee, I better check in. Of course, I'm not there yet, but I go ahead and check in. Now, that wasn't particularly brilliant, but I did it. So I check in, and they send a text to my phone. Just as I'm walking in the door, I immediately walk up to the counter, and I'm trying to get a Real ID compliant license. My license is up for renewal this year, and I'm trying to get a Real ID compliant. And you have to do all that George W. Bush stuff to put your documents in the system again that you put in 40, 50, 60 years ago, birth certificate and Social Security. And so I go in and I have all the list of documents I think I need, two proofs of address, and I have those documents. And the clerk says, well, you've done a really good job assembling your documents. He said, but you're missing one. He said, I don't see your Social Security card. I said, well, the number's been in the system for 50 years. He said, we still have to have the actual card, or we have to have at least something with the full numbers on it. And I said, so you can't do anything? Nope. He said, you got to come back. And I said, all right. He said, well, I'll give you a special pass. You can come in. He said, now we're about to close for lunch for an hour. He said, but come back at 1:30 and you can come straight up to my window.
Okay.
And I said, by the way, I said, can I take the eye test while I'm here? I said, because I've had this long-running battle with motor vehicles. They don't understand that you only need one-eyed vision. You do not have to see in both eyes to be licensed to drive. Now, I can speak for the states I've lived in, but you don't need two-eyed vision. And I'm legally blind in one eye. And they want to, they want me to read out of both eyes. And the private operators are the worst. They will tell you that it's by law you have to do that, and they give you a form to take to your eye doctor and tell you to get it filled out that says you're okay to drive, and I refuse to do that. I won't bore you with why I refuse to do that, but I don't take the form to the doctor. I just go to another motor vehicle office, and this time he says, oh yeah, you can take the eye test. Well, I took the eye test, had no problem. He says, why the worry about the eye test? I said, because they tell me I have to be able to see both eyes. And I said, they don't understand that. He says, well, we understand that here. And I said, yes, you're public. This is a public operated MVD here. And he says, well, come back at 1:30. So I go back at 1:30. And there's a dealer standing there just taking a lot of time. He sold a car to a young girl, and he's making sure he gets the title sent to him. He has his lien and everything. So he's setting up a lien, and I'm sitting there. Well, eventually I'm going to get up to the sky, and I don't want to have to take the eye test again, so I want to go right back to his window. And I go up to his window, and he said, well, he said, you've got your documents in order. He said, but the computer system just went down. I told you that was funny.
Okay, now that's funny.
But it gets funnier. So he said,
oh, there's more.
There's more. He said, you can hang out here. And it's already going on 2 o'clock. My appointment was 1:30. And after I wait for that dealer and after I wait to see this guy, it's already going on 2 o'clock. And he said, you can hang out here for a while. So I said, I'll hang out for a while. And then I just told him, I'm going to leave and come back. And I said, can I get a working phone number that you people answer? And I can just call you. I got some errands, and I'll call you and see if the system's back up. And he gave me a number. Of course, nobody answered it. You wouldn't expect anybody to answer a phone anymore. So I drove back over there before I left the area, and they were running again. So I go back in, and I told him, I said, well, I'm here, and I want to finish it out. He said, well, let's take your picture really fast. And I said, well, yeah, let's do that. I said, because it would be funny if the system went down again. And he looked at me really funny. He said, I don't see why that would be funny.
Right.
And I said, well, I've heard this would be my, I would have to come a fourth time. I said, that's what's funny. And he shook his head like there was nothing funny about that. Now that would, you have to admit that would be funny if I had to go back a fourth time.
It would be funny.
Okay. So that was my funny, but I did finally get everything in the system, and supposedly I have a new license on the way. It takes 15 days for them to process all that and merge it into their system. And it all went through.
Well, all right. Okay. Yes, that would be funny. Funny.
The look on his face when I said that would be funny was if I could have had a picture of it. Like I said, that'd be funny if it went down again. And he looked at me like, are you nuts or what?
Typical bureaucratic employee that has no sense of humor, right?
That's correct.
I got a question for you before we actually do start moving along. Remember we talked maybe a month ago about the Albuquerque police officer who was trying to do some pre-trial detention, try to get some relief from all that? What happened?
He lost. The state won their pre-trial detention motion, so he's having to sit it out in the Metropolitan Detention Center awaiting trial. And they made a big to-do about he was a threat, that there was nothing they could do that would keep the community safe from this predator while pending trial.
Well, that's very unfortunate for the individual. Innocent until proven guilty, yes?
Apparently not.
And he was considered to be at least not enough of a threat to society to become a police officer then, correct?
Well, that was before he solicited this teenager, though.
Yes,
now I understand. He's a dangerous man.
All right. Well, then I guess I will play this voicemail message that we got. Now, I got to tell you that the beginning, it kind of like he figures out what he's trying to ask as it goes on. But the beginning is a little, what's the word? Convoluted?
Yes.
All right. So here is a voicemail. Did he ever say his name in it? I didn't even get a chance to try and bleep it.
I don't think he did.
Okay, very good.
I just listened to the podcast. It says RM267 Adam Walsh Act, International Travel Debunking Myth. I have a question. If I was charged in Florida and I have to register for life in Florida, I don't know what would be the tier because everybody is in for life. My question is, if I move from a different state, move from Florida to a different state, I have to notify the registration what state I'm traveling to or what would be my new address in the other state. So let's say I'm homeless or I'm living in an RV and I'm planning to travel. And I don't have an exact address. Am I required to give them an exact specific address to which state I'm moving to if I'm just going to be traveling the country in an RV? And my understanding is most states require a registration if you're intending to stay in that specific state for more than 3 days or 72 hours. So if I'm, let's say, traveling to Georgia, and within the first 72 hours I travel, or I'm intending an international travel, so now I left Florida, so I'm no longer required, I'm required to register in a different state, let's say Georgia, but Georgia doesn't need me to register until, let's say, 72 hours of me staying there or about to. So let's say in first hour of me traveling to Georgia, I take an international flight and I move, let's say, somewhere else in Europe, Africa, or whatever. Am I required to tell Georgia or am I required to tell Florida? And that will be excluding the 21 days because if I'm in Georgia and I already told Florida that I'm moving to Georgia and I didn't give them a specific address, am I allowed first not to give them a specific address? And then if I'm in Georgia and I'm still not required to register unless I'm intended to stay for 72 hours, am I allowed to do an international travel without giving them a 21 day notice? Thank you. To appreciate it, guy, and FYP.
Good luck with that one.
Oh, well, it's actually, once you listen to it five times, you can figure out what he's trying to ask, but it is very convoluted. What he wants to know is if you travel domestically and move to another state, or if you just want to travel in an RV, can you do that without giving a specific address? The answer is yes. Now, that's from a legal perspective. The answer is yes, you can do that. From the reality of the registry officials, you may have a registration officer in Florida that says, I got to know where you're going. I got to have a specific address I can put in this system. That's something I can't fix. But as a matter of law, you have the right to travel. We're assuming that you're under no supervision. You're merely subjected to registration. He wants to know if he can travel in an RV, and the answer is yes. Undoubtedly, yes, you can travel. But you have to at least comply with your state's requirements. Some states have requirements. If you're going to be out of state for so many days, 7 days, or whatever the case may be, you have to tell them of that absence. Where he's going to get tripped up at is if you tell Florida that you're going to be traveling in an RV, and then you travel to another state with the intention of not actually connecting with that state, but you're trying to launch your international travel from a state that you're not connected to, which is what he's angling for there. He picked Georgia because it's a bordering state with Florida, and his theory is he'll travel to Georgia, and he won't stay in Georgia long enough to trigger a registration obligation. Then he will take an international flight, and then he wouldn't have been required to give notice because Georgia didn't have him in their system. Well, he's only partially right. Georgia didn't have him in their system yet, but Florida did. He didn't tell Florida he was taking an international trip. He told Florida he was taking a domestic trip. And therefore, Florida is going to be the one that he has to deal with, because Florida is going to say, nope, that wasn't what he told us when he left. If there was ever a situation where the U.S. Attorney's Office would prosecute a person, he would be it in that scenario, because that would be clear what his intent was. He was trying to skirt Florida's advance notice of international travel by going to Georgia and saying, well, I didn't have a registration obligation in Georgia, therefore, I and that would show a level of intent that would result in a conviction. So if you enjoy federal prison, I would say you just go right ahead and do that plan.
Club Fed.
That's what's going to happen on that. But without all the convoluted meandering around, he can travel. Anybody can travel. There's no prohibition against traveling. There may be some barriers in terms of notifying your registration officers. And then when you get to a state where you're traveling in an RV, you're going to need to be aware of how long you can be in a state before you have a duty to register, because even though there is no, there's not a hovercraft following you, there may be some mechanism that might yield proof of how long you're in that state, and you could possibly get prosecuted for being in the state too long without fulfilling your registration obligations. So I always tell people you need to know how long you can be present in a state as a visitor, and then make your decision about what to do in terms of registration while you're in that state.
I don't have any follow-up with that. That makes perfect sense. If he's just always registered in Florida, then unless he actually moves somewhere that has different rules, he's just jammed up.
Well, he's going, if he's traveling the country in RVs, he's got the potential of having a duty in those states, depending on how many days, how many hours he's there. If he was in state of Nevada, I think it's 48 hours. And right. On the 49th hour, the hovercraft would pinpoint him, and they would send all sorts of vehicles to surround him, and they would take him into custody and say, "You've been here 48 hours and 17 minutes."
I believe that, Larry, that there would be a something of a map that you could create, that you could hop state to state to state to state to state and stay a week or 2 weeks, possibly longer, and just meander about the country and never even be required to register. At least on the initial part, you would eventually have to come back around, and where they have like you, if you're here more than a week, but no more than 30 days in a year or something like that, when they have that additional annual number, you would probably eventually trip that number, I should say.
You could. And then also you've got your check-ins required in the state of Florida. If Florida, this is one of those things where there's not an answer because nobody contemplated this stuff. But if you're out of Florida and you have a 90-day interval to register, and you're not back in Florida to register and update your paperwork within that 90 days, what would prevent Florida from putting out a warrant for you?
As I just said in chat, Florida just gets marked off the list. I know that this guy is from Florida, but the scenario I just laid out, you just got to stay away from Florida at all costs. Probably pretty much the southeastern quadrant in general too. Georgia happens to be something of kind of like an oasis for some reason.
Well, it was because of that litigation by Wendy Whitaker primarily. There were several cases in Georgia, but that was the best one that had an impact on Georgia's requirements.
And go back to your to the comment that the person made on YouTube about challenges. Why don't you people file more challenges?
Well, it wasn't why don't we file more challenges. It was why do we file challenges? Why are we? What does he say specifically? Why do we file?
God, now I don't have a clue. Vamp again. I got to go get it again.
That's all right. But
I'll get it. Just give me a second.
It was more of a question about why are we down on them for trying the challenge when it didn't work? How will you know what's going to work? We're not down because they tried a challenge. I didn't say they shouldn't have challenged it. I said that they shouldn't have gone after the governor, the state police chief. And I said they shouldn't have done it so sloppily by making statements that they made like, we believe stuff. You've got to prove stuff. Believing it is not enough.
This person said, are you two suggesting that there should never be lawsuits? How can we know that what's possible if nobody ever attempts a new approach?
Yep, and there was nothing wrong with the approach per se. It's how they did the approach. If you're going to do novel litigation, you got to do it the best you can. And throwing everything at the sink, at the wall, and hoping it sticks is not the right approach, in my opinion.
I got to go find that one where we covered it a year ago, where they had 70 different points that they hit at the registry from, you know, your mama says it's a good thing. The list just went on and on and on. They tried literally to throw everything at the kitchen sink. And do you think that in that kind of circumstance, does the court just get irritated and then they just start throwing stuff out without even looking at whether there's merit?
There is some of that. When a case is exceedingly complex with so many issues, it does tend to overwhelm the court.
If you go in there with two or three or something like that of just quality, solid, here's the point, here's the evidence, here's the reasoning, then like, okay, well, we can dig into this one, not throwing everything in the kitchen sink at it. All right. Let us move on to a question. I believe that this is one question from a person named Chris. Is this the one that I sent you from Patreon?
Yes, it's just a comment, really.
Yeah, okay. So it says, I got lucky and only got 10 years of supervised release, but I knew many others got lifetime. Under federal law, you can petition for release anytime after a year, but most people say wait until 50% of your supervised release is done. The PO was actually the person who advocated for me to transfer my jurisdiction from Utah to Oregon. His logic was that if I violated, he did not want to have to appear in Utah to see the judge. It also would prevent an in-custody transfer from Oregon back to Utah for me. Sadly, I violated about a week after the transfer took place, so I was okay with the transfer. The negative was I got assigned to a judge known as the most conservative judge in the Oregon district. What is this expression here? He says would prevent an in-custody transfer from Oregon back to Utah. What is a custody transfer? Is that what we always talk about where they do the retaking?
Yes, if it's not retaken under the federal system, it would just be he would have to be transported back to the sentencing jurisdiction. And if you can avoid that, if you can get to the jurisdiction of the court, if you were sentenced in Alabama and you're in Oregon, you wouldn't want to navigate the United States in a custodial situation to get back to Alabama. You'd rather see a judge there in Oregon.
I see. Okay. Anything there before we move along?
The only thing I can say is that when we hear that POs do good work and good things, we give them a shout out. We don't know who the PO was, but this PO apparently advocated for him. And unfortunately, the PO got kind of screwed because it sounds like he violated very quickly.
Yes, it does. Yes, if the person advocated for you and then you screw up a week later, that probably doesn't go well for them. All right. And then for another comment is this may be a subject for discussion. The difference between the federal charge of possession of the minor kind of content, 0 to 10 years, and receipt of CP, 5 to 20 years, 5-year mandatory minimum. A case that may be worth looking at for some info is U.S. versus Dunn, and that's Michael Lauren Dunn. He was a friend of mine in prison. He got hit for both, but the appeals court struck down one of the charges since they were the same case. Also has some info about victim restitution, though I believe it may not apply any longer due to the Amy, Vicky, and Andy Child Pornography Victim Assistance Act of 2018. Of course, that act may also be a good subject for discussion as well.
I will look into that case, but I'll say this. The U.S. Attorney's Office is always going to file the higher charge because it gives them more leverage. So if there's a mandatory sentence with the receipt of CP and there is not a mandatory sentence with possession, what do you think they're going to charge? Because I can't imagine how you would be in possession of it if you didn't receive it to possess it.
Well, definitely if they're going to have the option of hitting you for 20 and then you'll take the 5-year plea, like they've still won. They got the conviction. They don't get kudos for how many years you got. They get kudos for the conviction.
Well, some prosecutors are proud about how many years that they've managed to impose on people. They'll say, well, I was in the chief prosecutor. I handed out 9,240 years of prison time. I got those criminals out of our neighborhood.
Somebody asked in chat, I hope that this is a relevant question. Are appeals decisions precedential if they don't go to the state Supreme Court? And then he corrects it, or federal Supreme Court. Is that a clear enough question to ask?
Appellate courts can be presidential unless the court doesn't want them to be. So it can be appeals court in a state. If you're taking up an issue in the New Mexico Court of Appeals and the next New Mexico Court of Appeals rules in your favor, that is a presidential decision. It expands the jurisdiction of that impact of that case from the judge that made the decision in Albuquerque to the entire state. Now, if the state attorney general appeals to the New Mexico Supreme Court and they grant cert and they overturn the Court of Appeals, it's no longer presidential. But yes, an appellate level jurisdiction decision is binding in the jurisdiction where it was issued at. So an 11th Circuit decision would be binding in all three states of the 11th Circuit. 11th Circuit Court of Appeals decision. A Georgia Court of Appeals decision would be binding in every county in Georgia, unless they deemed it non-published. And that way you can still cite to it if it's non-published, but you can say it's persuasive authority. It's not binding.
So, and that then is a similar, just, it's just, if something happens only in the state of Georgia, then Tennessee can say they did this here, see, and while it doesn't mandate something, it's persuasive. But going across districts in the circuit courts, then that would be similar, that if you're talking about something that was decided in the 11th, it's not binding in the 9th, but you could say they did this here, so we should do it here too.
Absolutely. And the Halloween sign case in Butts County, Georgia is a great example of that.
Yep.
That has no control outside of those three states. But if someone in Missouri wanted to litigate that issue because it's in their statutory scheme about Halloween, or maybe even Tennessee, I think it's in their statutory scheme. If they wanted to litigate, they would cite to the 11th Circuit decision and they would say, this is persuasive. I mean, this is great logic here by the 11th Circuit. And the circuit that's looking at that would either be convinced or they would say, nope, it's not all that compelling to us because our law has some distinguishing factors. Or they'll say it's great, and we're going to adopt that same reasoning here.
Yep, I gotcha. Let us move along. There's a lot of comments in chat of people going, ugh, so it just depends on your answer. Let's do a couple things about moving. So this is somebody that says, hello, I am seeking some advice, and I think you may be uniquely qualified to answer my question. I'm a PFR in Alaska, and I've managed to become somewhat successful here, but am emotionally drained from vigilantes targeting me. Normal people ostracizing me and making less money than I am qualified to make due to my employment discrimination. As such, I find myself considering leaving for Germany. I was about to do so several years ago when a vigilante cost me another job, and then COVID-19 happened and put that plan on hold. At that time, I was planning to seek asylum as I'd completed my probation a year prior, and a vigilante had just gotten me illegally fired from my job, and the EEOC was ignoring my claim. Considering leaving now, a few important things have changed. Alaska declared mandatory PFR registration unconstitutional based on the state constitution. I am in the lowest risk category of offender and have no other criminal record, so I shouldn't have to register anymore. The issue is you have the burden of suing the state for removal, and even if I manage to do so, Alaska refused to pardon or seal the records of anyone ever and has no limit on background checks. I had a lawyer quote me $3,000 minimum for attempting this, and I'm wondering how this situation might affect whatever I do regarding Germany. I think it, plus my registration period being only another 10 years at most, might have me denied asylum. I have been the target of at least a half dozen vigilantes, including one that was a police officer, so this may be a factor as well. To continue, do you want me to stop and have any comments before I go on?
Not really, because I'm not qualified on most of it. You're getting to the part where I am qualified.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I wasn't sure you weren't qualified for some of those things. I think you are, Larry. You're uniquely qualified even. So to continue, Germany amended its citizenship law a couple years ago. They made citizenship by declaration much easier. I just barely qualify via one of my ancestors. The issue is the law says no criminal record. I looked up the German guidelines on my offense, possession of CP in the German legal code, as it says that kind of record is erased after 5 years of completing your sentence if you are not charged with a new offense. and I'm wondering if this means my American offense would not be held against me since it is older than that. I would much rather obtain German citizenship than claim asylum because I could potentially continue to have real estate assets here in the U.S. and thus more income. I contacted a lawyer and they wanted $450 just to tell me yes or no regarding whether citizenship by declaration is even possible for me, and they want $4,500 for submitting the application for me. The $450 seemed reasonable to me, and I'd like your thoughts on the $4,500. I can't afford to spend that kind of money at present because my jobs haven't been making me as much as they used to. I'm mostly trying to plan for when I can. Again, I prefer citizenship to my real estate assets, and I'm not wanting to have to fear arrest if I ever left Germany. Wow, that's a lot. Hey, that's concise, kind of like that's getting to the point and giving you some meat to work with.
Well, I think he said the $450 seemed unreasonable. At least that's the way I'm seeing it here. But for the consultation, I don't know anything about immigration law, and certainly nothing about German law. So of those things, I don't know that I can be helpful. I know how lawyers operate. I know some good questions to ask lawyers, and I generally can figure out when they're giving you smoke. And I've learned that most of the time people don't want to know when they're being smoked out by a lawyer with BS. It sounds like this one might be an exception. He might want to know because he's being hesitant about spending $4,500. But he sounds like he wants to do dual citizenship. He's not gonna renounce his American citizenship. He didn't say that. That's a good thing.
He says he prefers citizenship due to his real estate, but he doesn't say he wants to give up his American citizenship, though.
Yeah, that would make him a dual citizen.
Sure.
And if he has dual citizenship, he can come back to the United States if he wanted to. I can't imagine why he would want to if they have a much better treatment of PFRs in Germany and he can become a German citizen. I can't imagine he'd want to, particularly if he can run his business, American business, from Germany. But the $4,500 is not that much money if the person knows what they're doing and if they're going to actually provide value for it. I would pay $4,500 in a heartbeat. When people say, it cost me $5,000 to get off the registry, and I say, well, if the registry is as bad as what you say it is, wouldn't it be worth $10,000 or $15,000 to get off of it if you have it?
Yep.
If the registry is as bad as you say it is. But you want to make sure that the person has the skills and the understanding of the interplay of German law and American law. And there's a lot buried in this thing about whether he would surrender any American rights. I don't think he would, but I'm not qualified to say that. But $4,500, first thing I'm going to ask the lawyer is what his expertise is in German law. And if he says none, I'm going to say, what do you plan to do to become an expert?
Yes, if I give you $4,500, what is your immediate education program to get up to speed on it?
And, and there is some research. There will be some research involved in figuring out what Germany will do. He could certainly consult a legal professional in Germany. I assure you that there are a lot of people in Germany who speak very fluent English.
Right.
I know that because I used to do property management and I had a continuous flow of German students and they were very fluent in their English. And I suspect you won't have any problem finding a German, whatever their equivalent of an attorney might be, to discuss the matters of how the German immigration system would look at his request for citizenship based on this old conviction that's more than 5 years old. And then the American lawyer might want to work with the German lawyer to make sure that everything done on the state side is correct. But don't give up your American citizenship, folks. It sounds good, but it really isn't.
Should he get in touch with the guy we had on the podcast on episode 195 over in Germany, do you think?
Certainly that would be a possibility. I would suspect he knows more than the average person. He's successfully there.
And apparently has brought others over. You want to look up Common Sense Laws on YouTube and or justfactsnotfear.com. People are posting in chat. Shall we move along from there?
Certainly.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say F-Y-P.
All right, well, this one I sent to you, and you had also received it on your own. It says, and it says, I'm from Narsal, and I was recommended to talk to you. The letter is a little bit crude, and so that's a warning. And I have an urgent need, so I'm contacting anyone who might help. I am still fighting for my husband's life, a PFR in San Diego, and we cannot figure out how to get a successful interstate transfer to New Mexico. The injustice system is almost doing us both in. We almost had one, and it fell through because Bernalillo, say that word for me?
Bernalillo.
Bernalillo. Parole made. Anyway, that cruel decision. I can't talk about it. It's been ruthless for both of us trying to accomplish it, not knowing what to do or where he could live. And still very in love and working together. I desperately need someone who knows what the F they're talking about to act quickly and successfully. I will do as much footwork as it takes as long as it ends well. I've wasted too much time on ideas from well-meaning but clueless people. He will be homeless in San Diego in a month. We'll be looking for Bernalillo or Sandoval? Is that right? Sandoval?
Sandoval.
Oh, Sandoval. Why do you put the... Never mind. Sandoval counties. And at this point, I'll even live in the war zone. Please help if you can.
Yeah, well, we don't refer to that as the war zone anymore. It is now the International District.
Oh, I don't know. Okay, what is that?
It's an area of town where you tend to have an elevated rate of crime and a lot of poverty. And it kind of grew the name the war zone, but it's very rude to refer to an area as the war zone or the student ghetto or anything like that. All right. What do you want me to tell her about this?
Well, I mean, I've personally spoken to this individual, and then I have seen these miscellaneous claims come out afterwards. I certainly, from my perspective, Larry, I have never, ever wanted you to tell me something that is wrong or blow smoke up my rear end or anything of that sort. So I would want you to be brutally honest on, can I get off probation? Can I expect to get off the registry? Like anything that I ask you, I don't want you to bullshit me. So I would tell you, for you telling someone else what they're expecting, if especially if they're trying to go onto your home territory, tell them the truth. That's what I think.
Well, there's an attorney here named Ashley.
I know her.
Yes, and she contacted me many years ago about a loved one that she was trying to get into New Mexico that was on probation in Georgia, of all places.
Yep, coincidentally.
And I told her what they would do, how probation and parole would operate here. And at that time, she was a prosecutor, and she was just devastated. She said, there's no way. There's no way that the system is that evil and vicious. And I said, yes, way, there is. It is that way. This state is right up at the top of trying to keep people from coming here, particularly PFR offenders. They are going to do everything they can when you make an application to transfer here to find the slightest reason to say no. And sometimes they have to invent those reasons. They have to cough up something that, well, it looks like there might be a school bus stop about to come to this place. So they come up with imaginary boogeymen. But that should convey something to you when they play that kind of game with you. What do you suppose would happen if you did successfully get here when they do not want you here?
I would imagine that they're going to then be very creative in inventing problems for while you're there under some kind of supervision.
That is precisely what will happen. Here's the way they look at it. I'm not going to say it's right or wrong. We can't agree on the recidivism rate, but we can agree that there is some recidivism. They are forced to deal with people that are convicted here. They have some level of discretion with people who are not convicted here. They figure that if they keep 200 PFRs out that weren't convicted here, that whatever that level of a reoffense would be, whether it be 2%, 3%, or 4%, they would rather them be offending in the jurisdiction they were convicted in. They're going to do everything they can to keep from granting a transfer. If they do approve the transfer, they're going to be doing everything they can to find a way to violate you. That's just the reality of New Mexico Probation Parole Division. That's what they're going to do. And you're the exception if they don't target you. There have been a couple of people that have made it in from Colorado that I know. I helped them get here, and they've had very little problem from probation parole. But the overwhelming majority of them are targeted with really minor technical violations. They have arrest and hold powers here because they're allowed to treat an offender here the same as we allowed them to treat our in-state offenders. In many states, you would need a warrant to take a probationer into custody. You'd have to go convince a judge that that person had violated and posed a threat and needed to be taken into custody. All the probation officer has to do here is issue a hold and detain order. They take that order, they grab a team of probation officers, and they go out and arrest you, and they throw you into jail. And then that old process that we've talked about many times about violation, probable cause hearing, it doesn't work. And you sit in jail for weeks, months, not seeing any judges, just sitting there. And eventually you sign a waiver and you go back to the state that you were convicted. And then you find yourself stuck there again because you have to recompact out once you get back to that state and you let them do whatever they're going to do to you. You end up having to start the process all over again. If there are any options other than New Mexico, don't come here.
All right. I mean, I know a little bit about the situation, but it just seems that in the past, Larry, like if someone could get there, that is the place to be. Is this different because the person's on supervision and not just simply the registry?
That is correct. Supervision is tough here. We had a, I'm not going to blame the previous Republican governor because they were harsh in that administration, but they were harsh in the previous to that administration under a Democratic governor. These are career people that run corrections. They've been there a long time. They're very hard-nosed. And these policies haven't changed, even with this so-called progressive governor we have now. They have not lightened up any corrections, as far as I can see, in terms of how they treat people that are convicted of sexual offenses. If you're looking for an easy place to go, this is not where you want to go while you're under supervision. If you're only registering, the registry is not too bad here. But if you're paying your debt to society, particularly where you're going to be under state supervision, it's tough.
Because like where when I was on supervision, I was getting like forget travel permits, Larry. I could move around the state. Your people can't even like you have to get a travel permit to move to go visit your parents in another county.
That is correct. And when you leave Bernalillo County to go to Sandoval County, that's a cross county trip. You've got to get a permit to do that.
Does this even apply, Larry? If you live like, hey, it's a stone's throw, like across my backyard is where the county line is. Do you have to get a travel permit to go visit your neighbors that are in the other county that's behind your own property?
I suspect there might be some allowance for people who like work in a county, and they wouldn't have to get a travel permit to go to work every day. They would probably write in an exception for that, for you to go work. But like, for example, Rio Rancho is a suburb that's in Sandoval County. And if you lived in Rio Rancho and worked in Albuquerque, you probably wouldn't have to get a travel permit to go into Bernalillo County. But if you're going on anything other than work, I would say that they probably want you to get a travel permit.
That's bizarre. And like, you're going to be at this address for this time visiting these people, and you'll be back in 48 hours or something just to go to the other county. That's where Sam's is, and you have to get a travel permit to go to Sam's?
That would be correct if it's not work-related, but I think they would give you a little bit of slack for a job.
Yeah. I'm sure you'd have, you might have to get, a monthly repeating. I've known people that are truck drivers, and they just get a monthly reoccurring travel permit.
I've heard of that, but they don't tend to do that much here. You're going to have a hard time traveling while you're under supervision here. The kind of stuff you're used to that you've witnessed just doesn't happen here. When people go to conferences, not going to happen here. You're not going to be allowed to travel. Get over it.
Is your advice then that this individual should try to figure out how to go where her husband is instead of having him come to her?
That would be my advice, if that's at all possible. Otherwise, you're going to be regretting the decision. If you successfully move him here, the likelihood is very strong that you will regret that.
And him being in California, I have no idea, zero clues about what the probation system is like in San Diego.
It's a huge metropolitan area. It might not be too bad. I don't know either.
You can't really argue with the weather that much. It's probably a little bit some smog-filled area, but maybe that's pretty decent weather year-round. Well, Larry, again, that's why you're Mr. Doom and Gloom. But it's honest, and again, I would tell you, Larry, please, always be honest. Don't blow smoke. I don't think that you should be one of the people that paints a doom and gloom picture just because it's doom and gloom, but paint the accurate picture. Sorry if that actually paints you as Mr. Doom and Gloom. Well, let's talk about this Third Circuit Court of Appeals. I did read it, Larry, and to be honest with you, it's 105 pages, and I actually spent the time to memorize it. Why on earth have you put a gun case in here for us to talk about? What does this have to do with the registry? Are you getting more senile? I'm thinking it's definitely more senile. Each week, more senile?
Oh, well, I think it has some tangential connection. Let's hope so anyway.
The opinion says Brian Range appealed the district court's summary judgment. Rejecting his claim that the federal felon in possession violates the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. I don't see it yet, so keep working.
Well, I hope I can make the connection, so keep going and let's get it set up, and I'll try.
Okay. The material facts are undisputed. In 1995, Range pleaded guilty in the Court of Common Pleas of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, to one count of making a false statement to obtain food stamps in violation of Pennsylvania law. Now it's not just about guns, Larry, but it's also about food stamps. Though he did not recall reviewing the application, Range accepted full responsibility for the misrepresentation. Range was sentenced to 3 years probation, which he completed without incident. He also paid $2,458 in restitution, $288 in court costs, and a $100 fine. Other than his 1995 conviction, Range's criminal history is limited to minor traffic and parking infractions and a summary offense for fishing without a license. So we have gun stuff, food stamps, and fishing without a license, and you somehow have made the connection that this has to do with the registry, right?
Well, I'm trying. When Range pleaded guilty in 1995, his conviction was classified as a Pennsylvania misdemeanor, punishable by up to 5 years incarceration. The conviction precludes Range from possessing a firearm because federal law generally makes it unlawful for any person who has been convicted in any court of any crime punishable by imprisonment of a term exceeding 1 year to possess in affecting commerce any firearm or ammunition. So there, we're eventually going to loop back into here how this ties to the registry, but it's kind of blurry at the moment.
So in 1998, Range tried to buy a firearm, but was rejected by Pennsylvania's instant background check systems. Range's wife, thinking the rejection a mistake, gifted him a deer hunting rifle. Years later, Range tried to buy a firearm and was yet rejected again. After researching the reason for the denial, Range learned he was barred from buying a firearm because of his 1995 conviction. Range then sold his deer hunting rifle to a firearms dealer. What happened next?
Well, Range did what I recommend people do. He sued in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, seeking a declaratory judgment that this section we're going to refer to as just 922G violates the Second Amendment as applied to him. He also requested an injunction prohibiting the law's enforcement against him. Range asserted that but for 922G, he would be for sure purchase another deer hunting rifle and maybe a shotgun for self-defense.
I see that Range and the government cross-moved for summary judgment, and I know that this is your favorite. You are a big fan of summary judgment.
Well, not a big fan, because it can be an appropriate maneuver, but in most cases, we end up regretting. In this case, it worked to Range's advantage because the government did not carry its burden of proof. And because of it being a Second Amendment, the government had a burden of proof here.
The district court granted the government's motion, faithfully applying our then-controlling precedents. The court held that Range's crime was serious enough to provide him, serious enough to deprive him of his Second Amendment rights. In doing so, the court noted the two-step framework we established in the United States versus Marzarella, 614 Federal 3rd Edition, 85. Was that close?
That is great.
Okay. And what is that framework?
That framework as it exists was whether the conviction was classified as a misdemeanor or felony, number one. Number two, whether the elements of the offense involved violence. Number three, the sentence imposed. Number four, whether there was a cross-jurisdictional consensus as to the seriousness of the crime. And number five, the potential for physical harm to others created by the offense.
I see the government conceded that four of the five factors favored Range because he was convicted of a non-violent, non-dangerous misdemeanor and had not been incarcerated. While Range's appeal was pending, the Supreme Court decided New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, 142, I don't know what S and then CT is.
Supreme Court?
Oh, what? Okay, I can't say SCOTUS, but they can write Supreme Court this way. Ugh. A panel for the third court affirmed the district court's summary judgment, holding the government had met its burden to show that subsection 922G, paragraph 1, reflects the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, such that Range's conviction places him outside the class of people traditionally entitled to Second Amendment rights. What is a law-abiding citizen?
Well, according to the court, the phrase law-abiding, responsible citizen is as expansive as it is vague. Who are law-abiding citizens in this context? Does it exclude those who have committed summary offenses, such as petty misdemeanors, which typically result in a ticket and a small fine? They go on to say, we are confident that the Supreme Court's references to law-abiding responsible citizens do not mean that every American who gets a traffic ticket is no longer among the people protected by the Second Amendment. Perhaps then the category refers only to those who commit real crimes, like felonies or felony equivalents.
The court stated, having determined that Range is one of the people, we can turn to the easy question, whether 922G1 regulates Second Amendment conduct. It does. Range's request to possess a rifle to hunt and a shotgun to defend himself at home tracks the constitutional right to defend by Heller. The Second Amendment extends, prima facie, to all instruments that constitute bearable arms, even those that were not in existence at the time of the founding.
They held that because, and I'm reading again from the decision, because Range and his proposed conduct are protected by the Second Amendment. And they say, we now ask whether the government can strip him of his right to keep and bear arms. To answer that question, we must determine whether the government has justified applying 922G to Range by demonstrating that it is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. The court says we hold that the government has not carried its burden.
The government argued that weapon forfeiture was common back in colonial times. The court noted that founding-era laws often prescribed the forfeiture of the weapon used to commit a firearms-related offense without affecting the perpetrator's right to keep and bear arms generally. I think I'm starting to see the potential here. The court appears to have decided that the Second Amendment prevents a lifetime ban simply by using the categorical approach.
I knew that you were going to connect the dots. I knew you were going to. I had that confidence. The court noted that Range's crime of making a false statement on the application for food stamps did not involve a firearm, so there was no criminal instrument to be forfeited. And even if there were, government confiscation of the instruments of crime or for a convicted criminal's entire life differs from the status-based lifetime ban on firearm possession. So you take the weapon or the instrument that they used at the time, but you don't tell them, like sometimes people forfeit their vehicle, but you don't tell them you can never own another vehicle. And that's what this law does. But anyway, the government has not cited a single statute or case that precludes a convict who has served his sentence from purchasing the same type of object used to commit a crime. Nor has the government cited forfeiture cases in which the convict was prevented from regaining possessions, including firearms, except forfeiture precluded execution. I mean, if they executed you, you probably didn't get your stuff back.
Weird.
And so I'm optimistic that we can make this type of argument for those on the registry. Since the Adam Walsh Act prescribes a categorical approach to PFRs, the logic would be that a person who has had non-consensual sex with an adult poses no threat to children. Thus, a lifetime deprivation of basic constitutional rights is not appropriate as applied to those certain categories.
But that means such a challenge would also then leave some behind. Yeah, you would totally not, it's not going to wipe out the whole registry in one fell swoop by doing that.
It is not. But once we chip this away, if we can apply this logic and say, wait a minute, guys, we've just got this decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, the Third Circuit has interpreted it, that a lifetime forfeiture of a fundamental constitutional right can't be done, then we can make a similar argument that one of the most fundamental rights you have, I would say, would be to travel,
yeah,
to have relationships with people you want to bear children, to raise a family. And you can't, a PFR in Alabama that had nothing to do with children when their PFR offense was committed, to ban them from having a child and having, like, that statute in Alabama that's under challenge right now by an attorney out of North Carolina that's heading that challenge. This is good stuff, potentially, in my opinion, that we can launch additional litigation based on this reasoning of this case. That's why I wanted to talk about it.
And that challenge is, what's the summary of that challenge in Alabama? Is that somebody that is convicted of a PFR offense and is now having a child, and they're going to tell them they can't be with that child?
Yes, that Alabama replicated the Tennessee law that requires that you can't live with minors, okay, if you're on the PFR list. And Alabama has a similar statute, and Paul Dubling has launched a challenge. I don't know the exact status of it, but I'm sure we will be hearing more about it in about a week and a half in Houston.
Oh.
When he speaks. But that is really obvious to me that the same logic would apply.
That does sound reasonable. Where would you want to go with something like this? What would be the lowest hanging fruit? Something like that, where an adult convicts something with another adult, and then they bar them from having contact with children, and it's not related?
That's where I'd want to start. I would not want to end there, but I would want to start there with something that's got a person on the registry that had nothing to do with a minor. And it could be indecent exposure. It could be even non-consensual sex, because that doesn't endanger a minor. And I'd like them to make their argument that, well, just because you had non-consensual sex when you were 22 with a 21-year-old, that you pose a threat to children now that you're 45. I don't see how they could make that connection.
Same if you have a non-internet related crime and then they clamp down on your internet usage.
Correct.
Very good. Well, all right. You've taken one that's pretty off in the wilderness somewhere and kind of brought it back to where it has some semblance of focus, Larry. I appreciate the good job.
Well, I saw it posted on the affiliate list, and I saw it on the National Criminal Defense Lawyers. Now, the affiliates list, people were hopeful that this would be used for us. I didn't see anybody on the National Defense Lawyers list opine what I just did, but I think there's something to work with here.
Do you ever post anything like that? You're positing and opining on the NACDL list? Do you ever do that?
I ask a question occasionally. I don't post anything unless I'm answering a question for someone, because since I don't hold that precious admission card, I feel like that people would like, who is he to think he is to start telling us about the law?
Okay, then I have an idea, Larry. And I mean, you already write for the Narsaw Digest, but perhaps you could write a legal blog. Because, you know, like, there's SCOTUS blog out there. The person that writes that, maybe they have an attorney kind of degree, but they're not an attorney. So you could stand up a site or some sort of platform where you speak about these things from your expertise as a layperson. You could totally do that and not get nailed for it. Hey, look, I'm not an attorney. Piss off. This is just my opinion.
I could do that, but I want to put the Social Security people out of business first.
Yes, I know that you're hell-bent on knocking out the Social Security people. And now Al's about to hang up the line. So don't talk about Social Security anymore. Well, all right then. Is there anything else before we shut this father down?
Nothing other than maybe promoting the conference, the live stream that you're going to be managing for NARSAL.
Oh, yeah. There is the conference. Go over to narsal.org and you'll find links there. Probably conference.narsal.org would also get you directly there. It's a 3-ish day extravaganza of all kinds of stuff related to registry. Different speakers. Who would be a speaker that you think will be interesting for you to hear? I always love hearing Emily Horowitz. I think she's fabulous.
I was going to mention Emily, and Paul is a very good speaker. Paul Dubling, that is.
Yes, he is.
He's going to be there, and he really inspires people.
Well, very good, sir. And that is on the, when does that start? That starts next Friday, the 23rd. Not the 16th, but the one after. The 23rd is when that starts. There's a social on the 22nd, then it runs Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So if you see the goofy dude running all the computer stuff and jumping between the rooms, that's probably me.
That sounds good, and I'm planning on being there.
You are? So you're not going to bail out this year? You bailed out last year.
This year I'm going to do my best.
What would prevent you from going this year, Larry? An outbreak of another COVID kind of thing?
Probably that would be one thing, but just the pain management I'll continue to deal with. But I'm going to probably make it. The odds are very good.
Very good. Oh, someone said, make sure you bring your shower head and a fan, right?
I will definitely bring the shower head. The fan is going to be harder to bring.
But you'll buy one on site. I won't have a car this time. So we'll get you a fan. We'll go to Walmart or something and get you a fan.
If I need one, I will get one.
Very good. Larry, I appreciate all of it. Make sure everyone, you go over to registrymatters.co to find the links to everything. And please, please support the program over at patreon.com/registrymatters. And if you are not so inclined, make sure you press like and subscribe and thumbs up and leave a review. Those things also are ways that you can help in a non-monetary fashion. And they are also appreciated. And if that's all, Larry, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And I will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.